All right, now I pass you over, great pleasure, Professor Willis McNally.
Thank you, Mr. Hay. I'm delighted to be here. It's been something I've looked forward to for many months, almost as long as I've looked forward to the sabbatical leave that I'm now on, and that's been a very long time indeed. I've always had very strong, favorable impressions of British science fiction and British science fiction fandom, and anyone who's read my introduction to the Nebula Awards Volume 4 could tell you precisely how strongly I felt, at least about Stand of Zanzibar, and of course, which I thought was an excellent book, and some of the other books that Brian has written, and I'm just sort of out of my mind here, meeting these people that I've been writing about for so long in my field. I think I could be called basically a professional science fiction critic. Not that it makes any money at all. I would starve to death on the amount of money that I have made as a professional science fiction critic. It's paid me all of maybe 25 or 30 pounds so far in the several years which I have been occupying that field. But nonetheless, I do think that science fiction does need some kind of professional criticism. I do not mean to tee off on science fiction simply by saying that it is incredibly narrow at times, incredibly provincial, and at times almost unaware of what's going on in the outside literary world, because I could make even stronger strictures against the outside literary world. I would suspect that much of what passes as contemporary fiction today, the naturalistic, sterile, representational novel that we might find as, let's say, John Updike's Couples, is perhaps superlatively written, brilliantly stylized, and says absolutely nothing. We have, as I said a little earlier to some of you this morning, a menage a trois, a menage a quatre, and sometimes a menage a cinq. Pardon my French pronunciation, but you understand what I mean. And after you're about 100 pages in it, when you're up to your navel in pubic hair, then it begins to get a little too much. Now, this is the kind of thing, I think, that too much of contemporary mainstream fiction has been guilty of, repeating itself and going on and on and on this way. Science fiction in its own way has also been guilty of the same kind of thing. It has been guilty of, let's say, the Western story redone with the good guys in the white space helmets and the bad guys in the black space helmets and so on. But recently, I think perhaps in the past 5 or 10 years, there have been to me, as a lover of science fiction and as a member of the professional academy, so to speak, there have been a number of things coming about in science fiction which strike me as being of genuine hope, not only for the field of science fiction itself, but for the field of mainstream literature. My friend Harlan Ellison dislikes this dichotomy, and I suspect that sometimes it's artificial. Yet nonetheless, I think it is worthy for our purposes here to consider the two as if they were dichotomized and were at least temporarily different categories, because I'm going to try and work toward a union of them a little bit later on. Now, what have been some of these trends? I think perhaps they date back 10 or 15 years with works like Jim Blish's A Case of Conscience and Walter Miller Jr.'s A Canticle of Leibowitz. I suspect that what we have, if science fiction, let me interrupt myself for a moment, if science fiction deals ultimately with the interface between man and the machine and is concerned ultimately with the results upon man of the effect of the machine, I don't know if that's a decent definition, but it's one I'll work with temporarily. If this is what science fiction is all about, then nothing that is alien to man should be alien to science fiction. And too much has been alien to science fiction. we have had definite proscriptions against, let's say, up until the last couple of years, the use of sex in science fiction. Too many editors, as Don Wolheim could tell you, John Campbell is a typical example, refuse to believe that astronauts would want to urinate, to say nothing of wanting to fornicate from time to time. But nothing should be alien to science fiction. And what Jim did in Case of Conscience, what Walter Miller did in Canticle for Leibowitz, and what others have done since, but these were earlier examples, is to use theology, philosophy, or what you will, as viable, valid subject matter. One, of course, need not be a believer in order to use these artistic materials. As some of you may know, I try to pretend to be an expert in the works of James Joyce, and Joyce himself, if not strongly anti-Catholic, was at least strongly indifferent on the subject, but nonetheless, he did utilize the materials of Catholicism as one of the many artistic constructs that made Ulysses and Finnegan's Wake and so on great works of art. And so what has happened is that these writers, Blish and I know many other writers too, have been using these artistic materials as subject matter. For example, Frank Herbert's Dune asks a very interesting question. What if you have a genuine avatar, a genuine incarnation of the deity, who is forced by the incredible conditions of the planet on which he is incarnated to choose violence as his means of redemption rather than the means of redemption of, let's say, mercy and kindness and goodness that we would expect of the normal incarnation? Now, to be sure, Herbert is not always successful, and there are many flaws in his book that I don't want to go into at the moment. I'm simply considering what the artistic construct that is behind, that lies behind the work. And there are many writers who are doing this these days. Not that this is the only way that it can be done, but nonetheless that these are valid ways. I don't ask us in our professed agnosticism or our professed belief or whatever it may be to discard any particular method of utilizing the artist's vision. I suspect an artist, whether he be a painter, a sculptor, what you will, is attempting to take his vision of reality, which is something up here, and he is attempting to incarnate it into some particular order of reality. He hacks at it, whether it be stone or words or musical notes or what you will. He hacks at it, he shapes it, he forms it until that order of artistic reality does precisely what he wants it to do to achieve some particular artistic effect. That having been done, he lays it out there and he says, here, it's all for you. You must absorb it. And good science fiction these days is requiring a great deal more of its readers than, let's say, it did 15 or 20 years ago. And I think John's Stand on Zanzibar is a typical example. It requires a hell of a lot of its readers. And I don't know whether it's always successful, John. That's immaterial. The point is, it does require a reader that is willing to expect more than a simple beginning, middle, and an end story. I suspect that much of what is happening to break down these barriers between the two fields is, in one sense, McLuhan-esque. McLuhan is, this may sound contradictory because McLuhan in many ways is opposed to the printed word, but McLuhan is also concerned with what he calls retribalization, or the necessity for retribalization. And this retribalization becomes, at least from the artistic point of view, an artistic construct, an artistic entity, where we must, well, to use a science fiction term, we must sort of grok it in fullness all at once. Huh? I think you see what I mean. We must sort of absorb the whole rather than concentrating on this or any one of the specific parts. Now, one book then that I would like to talk about briefly that I think illustrates what is happening is Kurt Vonnegut Jr.'s Slaughterhouse-Five, subtitled Or the Children's Crusade. I understand it has just been published in the United Kingdom, and I commend it to your attention. It's been out about a year in America, which has been long enough for the initial reviews, some of which were rave reviews, some of which were puzzled and querulous and so on, but it's been long enough for there to have been a beginning of a body of criticism of Vonnegut's book in order that we can understand what it's about. For those of you who have not had the opportunity of reading the book, let me summarize it very briefly. In March 1945, probably in response to the importunings, whatever the noun is, of Joe Stalin, the RAF and the American Air Force firebombed the city of Dresden with about 100,000, no, I forgot, don't quote me on the number, but in the firestorm that followed as a result of the tens of thousands of tons of bombs that were dropped, nearly 250,000 people perished. Historians now almost universally agree that the firebombing of Dresden was totally unnecessary, that Dresden was virtually an open city, and that as a result of the firebombing, Dresden was a dead city. Now, Vonnegut himself was an American infantry soldier who had about a week before that been captured by the Germans and had been shipped in a cattle car to Dresden to serve out the rest of the war as a prisoner of war. With great ironic coincidence, he was kept as a prisoner of war in a slaughterhouse. Slaughterhouse 5 was the number, an abattoir, and it was the insulation of the abattoir that kept Vonnegut alive, and he emerged the next day after the firebombing into death. And it has taken Vonnegut approximately 25 years to lay that ghost, and Slaughterhouse 5 is his attempt to lay that ghost. And what he does essentially is to tell the story of what happened to him. He assumes the name, a significant one of course, of Billy Pilgrim, and he tells his own story. But in order that Pilgrim Vonnegut, and hence by extrapolation to all of us, can understand what is going on, Vonnegut uses a technique which is a very old one, but which the poet T.S. Eliot, who lived not too far away from where we are right now in Bloomsbury District for many years, what Eliot called the objective correlative, which might be simply termed a literary Pavlovian reflex. The artist says, Hamlet, and you begin to react. And then having reacted with what Shakespeare has previously created with Hamlet or something like it, you can then continue, or the artist can then continue building upon what the previous writer has already done. Yeah, it's legitimate literary theft, if you please, this method of literary illusion. But nonetheless, it is a it is a device that has been used by many writers and which Eliot himself brought to a particular high point in many of his writings. If you were to read The Wasteland or The Quartets or Prufrock or some of these other things, you can see exactly the techniques that Eliot does. In effect, he's saying, why should I try to repeat what Yeats did, what Browning did, what Keats did, what Milton did, what Shakespeare did, what any of these people did? Even if I had the ability to recreate all of this, why cannot I... They wrote for a different age, a different time. Why can I not use what they did and work from there in my own age, in my own time, trying to express it as best I can, working from their foundation? This is the objective correlative. It is a set of objects, if you please, that we can correlate with or that we can relate to and work on. My thesis is that Vonnegut uses the science fiction devices in Slaughterhouse 5 as an objective correlative. Now, it's a very basic thesis, but it's an interesting one. First of all, you must understand that Vonnegut himself now denies, all over the book jacket, that he is a science fiction writer. Those of us who have read, God bless you, Mr. Rosewater and Cat's Cradle and Player Piano and Slaughterhouse 5 know better. I'm not too sure why he denies his heritage, except that I think Vonnegut subconsciously realizes that many people who are not science fiction aficionados turn off on the word science fiction and put it into a nice, neat little category. Oh, you know, this is Thud and Blunder among the Stars. This is good guys, bad guys in space. This is... As Norm Spinrad calls it, Spanner and Gromit stories, something like that. We all know that science fiction is all of these things, but science fiction is much more. I'm just into Barefoot in the Head, Brian, and I know that I'm just 30 pages into it. I know damn well that it's much more than a Spanner and Gromit story. Am I correct? Oh, certainly, certainly. Now, as I say, I'm only 20 or 30 pages into it, and I had to leave it back home because of the extra weight. But nonetheless, this is what the writers are trying to do, is to get away from these things, and we know that science fiction is more than that. So I think Vonnegut is denying that he's a science fiction writer in order to reach more people. Think about that. Think about that. Now, that tells me nothing too much about science fiction. It tells me a great deal about other people. It's their loss, I suspect, that they have missed these things. All right. Let me examine this a little bit further, Vonnegut's thesis. He invents a planet, a Tralfamador, which is an invention from one of his earlier books. The planet is essentially a death planet. The inhabitants, who are shaped like green plumbers' friends, are, what do you call them here in this country? Plungers, we say. Plungers. Inhabitants, shaped like green plumbers' friends, are cyanide breathing. And Billy Pilgrim is kidnapped by these Tralfamadorians on flying saucers and carried away to the planet Tralfamador. There he is kept in a separate enclosure. He is given anything he can possibly want, including some of the more beautiful Hollywood stars. By the way, if I were Ted Sturgeon, I'd sue Vonnegut, because Theodore Sturgeon appears in Slaughterhouse 5 as Kilgore Trout, and not very complimentarily, I must say. At any rate, Billy Pilgrim is there, taken to the planet Tralfamador, where he learns the Tralfamadorian view of time. Now, those of us who've read science fiction anywhere from 1 to 40 years, as I have, realize that playing around with time in one way or another is a standard device. But this is then the objective correlative, the playing around with time. How can we begin with this and carry on to something beyond it? It's simple in the hands of Vonnegut. He assumes that this device, the Tralfamadorians, view all time as eternally present. not as being sequential in the sense of beginning, middle, end, as we do, yesterday, today, tomorrow, but all time is eternally present. I suspect much the same way that our traditional views of philosophy or theology tell us of concept of heaven, shall we say, the eternal present. All right. It is as if, and Billy Pilgrim makes this point, we were looking at a range of mountains where we can see them all at once. And so we can look at time as happening all at once. We can see what's happening now, what's happening yesterday, what's happening tomorrow. And if a person dies, the Trothamadorians say he's in a pretty bad condition at that particular moment, but they know that in all other moments, he's in a very good condition. So consequently, with this view of time, they are able to say, somewhat stoically, so it goes. And if death comes, so it goes. Because looking at the person again, he's alive, he's acting, he's behaving, he's in being. How does this then relate to the whole notion of the incredible horror of the Holocaust of Dresden? Vonnegut is saying that the only way that one can bear the unbearable or tolerate the intolerable is by adopting some sort of Trothamadorian notion of time, so that we can look at it and say, yes, it is bad that what we did to Dresden. But on the other hand, Dresden and the people in Dresden, at other times, now and forever, in the eternal present, are alive. So it goes. The phrase in the novel becomes incantatory. So it goes. And this very stoicism of acceptance, because of the understanding of the religious constructs behind it, enables us to accept. And at the end of the novel, with some sort of ever-returning spring, a bird is singing Potuit. And we have life again through the artistic construct of science fiction. And this is what a good writer can do, to bring these two things together so that we no longer have the sterile representationalism, we no longer have mad experimentalism for the sake of experimentalism, and we no longer have Spanner and Gromit stories limited to nothing but that kind of thing. We have something which, call it new wave, call it speculative fiction, call it science fiction, call it what you will, but it is the kind of thing that will enable us to understand the impact on man of the after the interface of the machine. And that is essentially what I wanted to say to you. Thank you very much.